Hi, I'm Matt Gibbs. I'm the managing editor of Improper Books, and you're listening to The Geek Show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Far Panel. We are back again. Something, tell a friend. I know the hip-hop.
Yes, it's good that you're down with the kids of, 13 years ago?
It's fine. If there's one thing I know about youth culture, it's that it's completely immutable throughout the centuries.
Is that Christopher Lloyd line from Back to the Future? Kids don't change, only the background changes.
Which also explains why Andrew West flares so much.
Oh, yeah. That does explain his wing colours as well.
Yeah.
Exactly. They said the flares and skateboard would never go together, and I proved them all right.
Well, to be fair, they haven't since about September 1977.
So yeah, this is not a fashion podcast. It's God, I hope not. That would be it.
Yeah,
and yet now I want to do one.
We couldn't have had more inappropriate presenters, really, if it was.
I wear clothes most of the time.
Well, I wear clothes. There's a difference between clothes and fashion, I'm told.
Okay, so...
Is it by the snooty people who inexplicably work in the clothes shops?
That's the ones.
I thought it was just Trini and Susanna, your hostile gurus, Mick.
Oof. Oof, but I thought I was making the out-of-date references.
Oh. I think we should all have a turn.
I'm sorry, but if there was ever two people on TV, I want a slap. The person who sometimes wears clothing is Andrew.
That's
and
me.
The other person who does clothes but doesn't do fashion is Mick.
That's right.
And then Exhibit C is me, Rob.
Sometimes we talk about comic books.
Yes.
It has been known, but only very occasionally.
Well, let's start off with a comic book character, Deathstroke. Deathstroke is a comic book character. I'm sure he is.
He is, and has been previously.
See, and even will be in the future.
See, I want a cat. I want a cat, and I want to call it Death, and then I can stroke the cat, and then I'd be Deathstroke.
No, surely you'd be Stroker of Death.
Isn't that what Deathstroke is? The Stroker of Death.
No, the Deathstroke is a killing blow. Whereas you would be... Yeah,
much like what Rob did to that joke, again.
Yeah.
How many more jokes need to die, Rob?
All of them. All of them need to die.
Blood must be sated.
All of them need to die.
Well, that mission is in your capable hands now, Rob.
Yes. Anyway, how did I forget that Deathstroke is the killing blow? Hey, even do a podcast about words and books. Anyway, Manu Bennett and a few other people who have been on Arrow... and work on Arrow, have been pushing for a spin-off TV series that focuses on Deathstroke. What do you guys think?
I wonder if it would be a spin-off too many.
I want it just so long as it's solely Deathstroke's adventures while stuck in that tiny cell on the island. Just every week a solid 45 minutes of him going, I'm going to escape one of these days.
Yeah. I can see how that might start to get a bit formulaic, though.
Yeah.
Which would make it perfect for the Arrowverse.
Ooh.
This is true.
Not,
I mean...
Not much scope for the flashback technique either.
Oh, no, there would be.
Yeah.
It would just be flashbacks to other times when he's still sitting in the cell.
And you'd only be able to tell it was a flashback because of the bleach bypass look that they're giving.
Yes.
Or the length of his beard. But then they could throw you off by changing the length of his beard every week.
Yeah, and maybe just to relieve the boredom in his cell, he moves his eye patch across to the other side every now and then.
He's not actually missing an eye.
Yeah, it's just an affectation. He told me if I wore an eye patch, I'd look rather villainous.
No, or maybe he just grew up forever wanting to be a pirate. I never wanted to be a mercenary, goddammit.
But I do wonder sometimes, because I do watch the DC shows, the Arrowverse shows, and they're okay. You know, they have their problems. But, you know, to kill 45 minutes of time in a sort of fairly light-hearted romp-type way, with the exception of Arrow, which is far too dark and brooding to be a light-hearted romp, it's good, solid comic book action.
Sorry, Arrow was dark and brooding?
Compared to the rest of the Arrowverse, yeah.
Okay.
No, what's that other word? Miserable.
That's more like it. That's more like it.
Yeah, it was a bit of a sulky mare.
Dark and brooding is TV speak for miserable. As in, a surreal twist means makes no sense.
Yeah, true.
So, yeah.
I'm still stuck on Deathstroke being a pirate. I think Captain Deathstroke is such a cool pirate name.
It would be a cool pirate name.
I'm pretty sure there is actually one of those alternate universe DC comics where Deathstroke is a pirate.
Really?
Yeah, I'm sure I remember it from something.
But I think as we discussed briefly in the last edition, there's pretty much an alternate universe where you can fill in character name is a different occupation for almost any combination in both DC and Marvel's universes.
Yes. Anyway, so Deathstroke getting a TV series, maybe.
Yeah. No, I'm not sold on it. I think they did a sensible thing with Legends of Tomorrow where they took the sort of lesser DC characters and put them all together. I don't think any single one of those on their own would have been able to carry a whole show.
That's true. And it's about the only sensible thing Legends of Tomorrow did.
And I think doing something with Deathstroke, yeah, you could play the whole is he, isn't he, good or bad this week angle. But even with that variation, I don't think it'd fly for more than a preliminary half season.
Yeah, I've got to agree. I don't think it'd fly for more than that either. I mean, you've got Marvel doing the Punisher TV series, which is probably the closest Marvel are getting to the Deathstroke character.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Actually, no, I can definitely see this series happening if Punisher comes out and it does really well, like I assume it is going to do, because Marvel properties are basically a license to print money.
Yeah.
I can very much see DC going, we want some of that. Let's do a Deathstroke series.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, was the Punisher series is coming out. They're going to want to do Deathstroke.
But it's going to be great, because there's going to be the constant question of, is this week is Deathstroke, is he going to angrily stab someone, or angrily shoot someone, or maybe even just angrily punch someone? It's a non-stop rollercoaster of emotion.
And not only that, but you've also got the added variable of, is there someone on the receiving end of the blade, stroke, bullet, stroke, rocket-propelled grenade, good or bad?
This is true.
It writes itself.
It does. It literally does.
Okay, shall we move on to Wizard World have announced their first inductee into their comic book Hall of Legends. Who do you think it is?
Alan Moore.
Sorry?
Alan Moore.
No.
Jack Kirby's incredibly bitter ghost.
Nope.
Joe Siegel.
Nope.
Johnny Comics.
Nope.
Bob Kane.
Nope.
Spider-Man.
Nope.
Frank Miller.
Nope. It's not Stan Lee either. Although he would be near, he would be among the people that you've suggested, the valid people that you suggested, that is, who I would have put near the top of being the first inductee into a comic book Hall of Legends.
Lou Ferrigno.
Nope.
Scotty Young for his sterling work on Variant.
See,
which I would absolutely say yes to.
I was about to say, I would say yes to that as well. It's somebody that Andrew doesn't like.
Oh, congrats, Rob.
You walked right in.
Ironically enough, his first name, isn't it, is Rob.
No, no,
yes,
no.
Yes, yes,
no, no.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Oh, God damn it. No, no, I'm not going to say it. If I don't say it, it'll never be true.
Come on, Andrew, you can say it together with me. Rob.
Rodriguez.
Come on, you know you want to say the creator of 90s pouches and garter belts.
Damn it, Rob Liefeld.
Yep. Of all the people they could have chosen,
physical embodiment of the 90s.
To be their first inductee in their comic book Hall of Legends.
You see, I think that should be a protest now.
Well, I'm just, I'm looking at this and thinking, I'm literally going through Bob Kane, Jack Kirby, Stan Lee, Alan Moore, Frank Miller, going through all of these people who I would have chosen before Rob Liefeld, or Liefeld, or however you pronounce his name. And I'm thinking, where the hell are they?
I'd have put the bloke who works in our local comic shop above him.
Yes.
And I don't mean Dave the owner. I mean the guy who's there, like, you know, on a Tuesday when Dave can't make it.
Apparently, Wizard World president and CEO John DeMatta, however you say his name, says, comics is where Wizard World began. Really, Wizard World? And the community continues to be a vital part of all facets of our company. We have worked diligently to make Artist Alley, blah, 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 John DeMatta speaking. Rob Liefeld is a perfect fit for Wizard World Hall of Legends recipient, a top creator whose work has gained worldwide acclaim in various media forms all the way to the big screen. Can anyone just bring out a convenient picture of Stan Lee at this moment in time?
Yeah. I mean,
I assume Stan Lee was already there shaking his head because Stan Lee is literally everywhere.
I
think on reading this news, it's a wonder we didn't all hear him exclaiming, "Oh, gee."
See, this is their first inductee into the Hall of Legends. I just want to stress that before anybody else, they've chosen Rob Liefeld.
See, now, if I was Alan Moore now and they offered me the next induction, I'd go, nah, stuff it.
Yeah.
I wasn't good enough for the first one. Stuff you.
But probably Alan Moore would probably say stuff you to the first one anyway because he's Alan Moore.
Yeah, but that's fine. But, you know, to be stuck in the queue behind Rob, a man who, let's face it, we're reporting this news and we don't know how his surname's pronounced.
Exactly. Because there's so many people who say Liefeld, and I'm like, but it's spelled L-I-E. Shouldn't it be Liefeld?
I say Liefeld because everything about him is wrong.
I'm going to go with Liefeld.
Liefeld. You're going to be...
Liefeld.
Are you going to be foreign to us? You're going to be continental?
I'm taking a leaf out of the football coverage I heard last night where Real Madrid were apparently going to return to their home ground of the Bernabeu. And that was a professional footballer saying that they were going to be returning to the Bernabeu.
I love football commentary and their inability to actually say words.
I believe this player has, in his career, actually had cause to play at the Bernabeu. But yes, so congratulations to Rob Liefeld.
Yes.
And get the hell out.
Has he actually learned how to draw women's feet yet?
Or just feet in general.
Yeah, but specifically women's. It seemed to be worse when it was the women. The legs just seemed to taper off into a point. It's like, you know, all women were on pinions at all times.
I mean, let's just face the obvious here. Rob Liefeld did not get very far down the picture he was using as a model before he just stopped and said, that's good enough. Drawing two gigantic circles.
Well, maybe this is it. Maybe he viewed, maybe he had a less than positive world view on the readership and thought, they won't look below there anyway.
True. I mean, one of the reasons why apparently Wizard World have chosen Rob Liefeld is because he's one of the founding members of Image Comics. And again, I'm thinking, where the hell's Stan Lee?
I think we should point out to listeners that you are, in fact, the adopted son of Stan Lee, and that this is why you're being so vociferous.
See, I wish that was the case. I'm sorry, but me and, like, half the comic book readers on the planet wish they were the adopted children of Stan Lee.
Except, of course, those who are the actual descendants of Kirby.
Is this another... Is this like, what was it, what was that feud between the American families, the one that lasted for decades? Is it the Kirby's versus the Lees?
The McCoys.
Yeah. Is this the Kirby's versus the Lees, though?
Oh, dear.
Stanley and Jack Kirby sitting either side of the river that runs through the Marvel offices.
On their rocking chairs with their shotguns. TV series.
We should do a comic book of this that then gets published by Marvel and then made into a film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe and then has a cameo appearance by Stan Lee.
As himself.
As himself. Yeah. Leader of the embittered feuding family.
Oh no, no, Stanley in a cameo as Jack Kirby. Delicious irony. We love you so much.
Yes.
On that note, we're going to take a break and we'll be back with Mucho Comics.
Do you know how to spell COMYX in true Rob Liefeld fashion?
Yes.
Liefeld.
Liefeld, because it's all a lie.
We'll be back after Andrew's taking some tablets.
Hello, are you enjoying the show? Well, if so, a donation would be a huge help and much appreciated and help us provide more geeky goodness for your ear holes. You can donate by pressing the button on the right-hand side of our website.
Hi, I'm Destiny Blue, the anime artist, and I like drawing and The Geek Show, which you are currently listening to.
Ah, there really is nothing like a first leather-bound edition of a classic Victorian podcast. Hello. We're literally loitering from The Geek Show, and we cover literally all types of books, from hardbacks to paperbacks to sometimes the words within them. If any of these things interest you, why not pop in and give us a visit on Literary Loitering.
Welcome back, and now it's time for comics, beginning with Mick.
Hello, yes, I've been delving into the science fantasy realm this week with the first volume of the complete collection of Valerian, which, for those of you who may have been living under a rock for the last few months, is the comic series that started in 1967 by Jean-Claude Mézières and Pierre Christin that have inspired the forthcoming Luc Besson movie. And that's not where the inspiration stops.
Yeah, wasn't there, I read somewhere that Valerian, the look of Valerian, was one of the inspirations for some of the designs in Star Wars.
Some of the designs, let me tell you, in this collected, because there's tie-ins to the movie in this collection.
Yeah.
There is a panel of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 almost direct lifts between the Star Wars films and the original Valerian comics.
Wow.
Like 1972, Valerian comic had a spaceship that bore an uncanny resemblance to a certain ship from Star Wars in 1977 that did the Kessler run in less distance than it actually was. Han Solo's Millennium Falcon. Loreline, Valerian's sidekick in The Land Without Stars, again in 1972, is seen held prisoner and wearing a gold bikini, a trick that wasn't pulled off again until Return of the Jedi in 1983. Valerian gets trapped in a stone-like substance in The Empire of a Thousand Planets in 1971, and Harrison Ford suffers a similar fate in 1980, and it just goes on and on and on.
Wow.
So... But reading through the first three or four stories in this collection, it's clear that it wasn't just George Lucas that ripped it. It was inspired by Valerian. I've seen parallels with plots from Doctor Who, Blake Seven, any number of superhero and sci-fi things. And it's quite naive, the artwork. Yeah. And the plot lines are quite simplistic, but they're from a simpler time. As I mentioned before, the run started in 1967. It's good, solid science fiction. There's a good, hard basis in it, but it's still looking at the same themes that are rife today in terms of humanity trying to live in peace, global catastrophe caused by climate change. At the point I'm in the story, the actual cause of that is not entirely clear. We know a bomb went off somewhere, but we're not sure why.
Was it Trump?
Not stated.
Hmm.
All we know is a bomb went off. We don't know who set it off or whether it was set off by accident or deliberately.
If through reading this you discover that the bomb was set off on purpose by an orange man with blonde hair,
then clearly we will burn the authors as witches. You know, I don't want anybody to think I'm unmeasured in my approach to dealing with these kind of things, but, you know, there's precedent. But no, it's, like I say, the artwork feels primitive compared to what we're used to today. They didn't have the printing technology that they've got now. They didn't have access to digital image processing before it went to print, so you don't get any of those weird focus shots that you started seeing in modern comics. It's good old the style most reminds me of the old Barbarella comic strips, which is not surprising considering that it's of a similar origin.
Yeah,
but it's that kind of simplistic artwork, very few colors, but used really effectively. Very big bold lettering, and it's nice and straightforward, but it's got a really good pace for all that, because although the story's run on for maybe 28 pages, there's something happening on every single page. There's no messing around and sort of describing some great angst-ridden event that doesn't actually move the story forward. It's just, oh, that didn't work, we better go over there. All right, we've arrived here. Let's get on with what we need to do next. It's great pacing, and I would say that for anyone who looks at it and goes, nah, you are a fool, and you should delve further in. I certainly will be delving further in, and, you know, with the odd exception, I tend to love Luc Besson's work, so I'm really looking forward to the film of this as well.
I've got to admit, I am as well, mainly because I adore The Fifth Element. I'll be honest, it's one of my guilty pleasures.
I've got to agree. I don't think it's a guilty pleasure. I think it's a pleasure you should revel in.
Well, it's one of my guilty pleasures.
And share with others.
It's one of my guilty pleasures because I'm not a big Chris Tucker fan.
Nah.
His voice. It's that high-pitched scream.
But
I'm going to say it. I enjoyed Lockout. You know, the one where it's basically Escape from New York, but in space and with Guy Pearce.
Okay, yeah. And who doesn't like Leon?
Well, indeed. Natalie Portman's finest performance ever.
Everyone remembers that performance.
That was the wonder she did before she forgot how to act. But yeah, it's very rare I've seen Luc Besson put a foot wrong. So, and the source material is sound. He's very passionate about his love for the source material. In fact, the reason that he's making the movie now and not previously is that he's been waiting for the technology to catch up, because across the entire sort of 40-year run of the comics, there are about a dozen human characters.
Yep.
So, so yeah, it's made me more excited to see the film than I was before.
Cool. Andrew, do you want to go next, or do you want me to?
If I have to, I guess. So, I've been reading a lovely chunk of Hellboy, but what I've not been reading is Hellboy in Mexico, which you promised me, Rob, and lied to me about.
I didn't promise you Hellboy in Mexico.
You said Hellboy in Mexico, and this is not Hellboy in Mexico. This is Hellboy Into the Silent Sea.
That's what I told you.
As you will note, is a different location to Mexico.
I didn't say anything about Mexico. I think you dreamed it. I think you dreamed it.
No, I'm sure the first time we talked, said you got a Hellboy thing in, Hellboy in Mexico. I was like, oh yeah, I'll take that.
No, I said it's a Hellboy hardcover.
Did I just...
I think you imagined it.
You've lied to me so much, Rob, it's kind of hard to tell when the real stuff ends and the dream stuff begins.
Also, don't forget, when we were doing the last edition, there was a space warp opened up. That could have caused the problem.
That's true.
So in the other reality, he said Mexico, and in this reality, he said hardcover, which sounds almost but not entirely unlike Mexico.
Okay, just to realign myself, Rob, you were the one who shot JFK, right?
No.
So that's the reality we're in.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't actually aiming for him.
That's not the question that was asked.
I was
no
aiming
asked
for the
who you were aiming for.
I was aiming for the grassy knoll, but
which just goes to show how accurate you are with a firearm.
About 300 meters wide. I was hunting pheasants on the grassy knoll.
Ah, yes, Dallas, that famous pheasant hunting ground. Anyway, Andrew, tell us
for against the NRA.
Andrew, tell us more of Hellboy.
Yes, Hellboy Into the Silent Sea. So this is from the early 2000s-ish, and is set after Hellboy the Island, which is a story in which Hellboy finds himself on an island, strangely enough.
This sounds like the slowest escape saga ever written. So we've had him on the island, and now he's in the sea.
Is this the Hellboy version of Escape from Alcatraz?
It's Hellboy Lost.
Now you've spoiled the bit where I say written by Damon Lindelof and Carlton Coos. But no, this is Mike Mignola, but with art by Gary Gianni, who is not Mike Mignola.
Okay.
So yeah, let's see. Oh boy, he's been on the island. At the end of that, he escapes off in a boat. And in this, he gets picked up by another ship full of 19th century sailors. And the sailors they go around collecting oddities. So basically, the captain kind of takes in Hellboy and decides he's going to sell him to a circus, display him alongside a Fiji mermaid. So Hellboy, he's stuck on the boat. He's all tied up in chains. And he finds that the crew are also trying to find Heka Emen Ra, the serpent from the beginning of the world. And guess what? Doesn't go well.
They find it.
Yeah.
Is there mild peril?
You know what? I would even say there was greater than mild peril.
I never understood that phrase, mild peril. Surely if you're in peril, then you're in peril. There is no mild about it.
No, there are degrees of peril.
Are they?
Yeah.
Or is it? Can I get one? Is it like a BSc or a BA? A master's degree?
Well, I guess mild peril is kind of the Doctor Who, the monster is slowly walking down the hallway with its hand outstretched at me.
Yeah, but there is an escape route. Whereas extreme peril would be the monster's 1 foot away and there is no escape route.
See, I want the type of the spelling error version, the extreme barrel. So no, just...
I think you got that in Earthshock.
Was there a character called Beryl in Earthshock who was just totally ran extreme?
No, the captain in Earthshock was played by Beryl Reed. That was definitely a case of extreme Beryl.
Anyway, Andrew.
Yes.
So, yeah, I've completely forgotten what I was there. But basically, they do some sailing. They get crashed on some rocks. They get assaulted by horrifying fish monsters. All that kind of good stuff.
Just another day for Hellboy, then.
Yeah, which that is one of the things I love, is just how this is just another one of those things. Like, there's a bit where one of the members of the boat tells Hellboy all about the serpent and how it, kind of talked to an entire civilization who rose up and then fell on their own vices. And then Hellboy just says, well, yeah, listen to a talking snake and there's going to be trouble. But that's what I love about Hellboy, is that all this is just like another day in the office.
But it kind of should be. It's one thing that bugs me about a lot of genre stuff is that, you know, some hellspawn or alien invasion is causing an apocalypse and everybody panics wildly, even though the same thing happened last week.
Do you know who...
You'd think they'd get used to it.
Do you know who actually did that whole getting used to it really well? Was the first Ghostbusters film. You know, after a bit, they were just so jaded and worn out. That when Winston turns up, like, yeah, you're hired.
Yeah.
I just love the transition in that movie from, it's all, you know, everyone's just kind of, oh, the ghosts are real and they're capturing them, to just a few weeks later, they just burned out and everybody's running on caffeine and nicotine.
I enjoyed this book. It's basically Hellboy with lots of vaguely Lovecraftian overtones.
Yes.
Which is like, the meeting of the two things I love the most.
And who doesn't love a Lovecraftian overtone? Be a good name for a band, that.
Lovecraftian overtone, that is a good name for a band.
Yeah. Quick trademark it.
No, because the last thing you want is me in a band in any way, shape or form.
Don't need to form the band, just trademark the name.
I could be the manager.
Every gig of Lovecraftian overtone has to end with just all the ears of the audience bleeding and no one wants to say what happened.
Yep.
Yeah. You see? I think Rob would be perfect in this band.
Just have me at the front as the singer. Yeah. Nobody can remember the words because I go for emotion in sonic form.
And that emotion is pain.
No, fear. Don't forget the fear.
I thought you said I go through emotion in sonic form, which is very different.
That also happens. Going completely left field for me. I got Luck from NBM Graphic Novels. It's a nice little hardback story, sci-fi one by John Nielsen. Really simply drawn, real simple, you know, paneling, real simple characters. Everything is nice and straightforward, very clean lines. And it's a bit odd because it's a sci-fi about a little robot wandering the desert and his friend, the little robot is called Artie, and he's got a friend who's a vulture called Owen. And Artie is trying to find out why he's wandering the desert. And so he goes to a village where there's talking animals and they tell him that they don't know. So he goes to the factory. They say they don't know. And then they want to wipe his memory because they think he's defective because he's trying to find out why he's wandering the desert. And then he rebels, as robots apparently are wont to do when you threaten to wipe their memory. So Artie escapes and he's looking for things. And it's him and Owen basically against the world. It's weird because this is one of those odd little stories that I didn't expect to like, and I do like it because it is really, really, really simple. It's like you were talking about Valerian. It's a very, you know, the story is very simple in its approach. It doesn't really have much in the way of artifice about it. And this is, again, really simple in its approach. It's just saying, here's a little robot looking for some kind of purpose in life external to what it was programmed to do, and it finds it. Hooray, everybody be happy. It's Wall-E, which it basically is. It's like a weird graphic novel spin-off of Wall-E.
But with added vulture.
But with added vulture. It's weird because you never once question the fact that the robot can talk to the animals.
No, what I'd be questioning is the fact that the animals can talk.
But the thing is, you never question that. Because it starts off with Artie talking to Owen, and it becomes one of those Bugs Bunny things, you know, Bugs Bunny, Elmer Fudd. You never question the fact that Bugs Bunny can talk at all.
Nah.
Nobody ever says, hang on, why is that rabbit talking? And it's the same with this. You never question the fact that he's talking to the vulture, and the vulture is actually replying. Or when he goes to the village, he talks to animals. Never comes up. But it's one... Okay, it's a very simple read. It's a very nice little read. It's enjoyable, and unfortunately, it's also a little bit forgettable as well, because it is a bit too simplistic.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with being simplistic, but when it goes a little bit too far, then the story can become forgettable. There's no real sense of peril, to use your words.
No mild peril.
There's mild peril from time to time when Artie's when they're threatening to get rid of Artie's memories, but that's about as far as it goes. And there's no actual, you know, there is a sad bit towards the end, which I'm not going to spoil. If somebody wants to read it, they can. But it does kind of bring Artie's personality, you know, bring his whole existence into a more human light. But ultimately, it's a happy ending, and you kind of expect the happy ending from the very beginning. The characters do develop in certain ways. Well, Artie does, definitely, but not many other people do, and it seems like that's the whole thing. It's all about this one little robot, which is why I liken it to Wall-E, because Wall-E is that one little plucky robot who's doing stuff. Where this differs is that there are other robots in existence, and there are the animals to talk to, whereas Wall-E was by himself.
Wall-E had all the other garbage repair robots, who he also possibly killed for his replacement parts.
Yeah, I know, that's the horrific backstory.
That's dark Wall-E.
Yeah, that's the horrific backstory to Wall-E that never gets mentioned. It's like the Hunger Games Wall-E version. It is, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's...
I was thinking more like Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, no. You remember Jet Li did that movie called The One? Maybe that's what Wall-E was doing. He was killing the ones like him and taking their power.
All the other Wall-Es must have sucked then. It's like, that's the best Wall-E you get after traversing the multiverse.
Yeah, but let's face it, they weren't exactly sort of like, you know, combat droids, were they?
No. So yeah, that's Luck by John Nielsen.
That's because you're not a garbage droid, you see. These things are relative.
Yeah.
If you're a garbage droid and you see another garbage droid with a better attachment than you, you want that attachment. Whereas to us, that seems trivial.
Yep. Anyway.
I don't know. I've seen plenty of large attachments that I would like.
We are not going there, Andrew.
No.
That was Luck by John Nielsen. Moving on. Who's next?
Well, as you know, I keep working my way through the Judge Dredd mega collection, and moving on from the last edition when I mentioned the Banzai Battalion, I'm now on to Fast Food.
Oh.
A collection of stories about the fact that life in Mega City 1 is quite boring. 87% of the population are out of work, and in many ways, a bit like the old story about, you know, to get yourself off the mean streets and out of a life of crime, you go and take up boxing and become a professional boxer. In the world of Mega City 1, you relieve the boredom by becoming a professional eating contest.
And you become the eater. I was going to say...
Yeah, no, you don't become a contest. You become a competitor. I was just struggling to find the right wordage. And so that's what Fast Food is. It's a collection of stories about the fatties. And it's another instance of how even the stories that are set in, like, that were written in the 70s and 80s around Mega City 1 kind of predict stuff that's happening now. And in many ways are a warning that we ignored. So, yeah, the obesity crisis that we hear of so much in the news is a major problem in Mega City 1. After the Apocalypse War, there are food shortages, so the eating contests are outlawed, and you've got underground feeding rings where they're force-feeding competitors and getting charged with murder because the body turns up and they've accidentally overdosed on appetite enhancer and eaten their own bed and choked on it. And it's just so over the top. But at the heart of it is this nugget of a warning of, you know, if you're eating because you're bored, you might end up with a wheel in front of you to balance your belly as you go down the road.
Wow.
And that's what they have. They have belly wheels. In fact, some of the leading competitors in the eating contests have got a rear belly wheel as well, which I'm not sure is supporting their belly anymore.
So they've got a front belly wheel and a rear belly wheel.
Only the really, really, really good contestants have got a rear belly wheel.
So they're like a beanbag on a motorbike?
Basically, yeah.
Wow. That is a...
like a mark of prestige.
Well, yeah, because this is the thing. If you have, like I say, only 13% of the population have got a job, and it's never specified, but I've got to assume that that includes the people who are in the judge ranks as well. So it's a very small number of the population that have got a job. So this professional eating lark is quite literally big business. And they're talking about, you know, the proudest moment of one competitor is when he manages to eat 1,000 kilograms of food in an hour.
What?
Yes. It's a kind of force-feeding tube thing that happens.
And yet there's a food shortage.
Well, this is one of the later stories when the food shortages have been eased by the setting up of Munce Farms just outside the city.
Okay.
So, but yes, it's like a lot of the Judge Dredd stories. The stories are humorous, but with a dark undertone. There's a warning in there: ignore it at your risk,
and don't be fat.
That's the essential message.
Oi. I'm working on it.
So, yeah, and again, the Fast Food Collection features the talents of John Wagner, Alan Grant, Mick McMahon, Carlos Esguerra, amongst many others. And, you know, as is always the case with these collected volumes of stories from across sort of nearly 40 years of Judge Dredd, there's a variation in quality. Some are better than others, but on the whole, it's an entertaining read.
Cool.
So, back over to me.
Yes.
So, I've got another book from Dark Horse, just like Hellboy Into the Silent Sea was, and that is the thing that I mentioned when I started talking about it, because I'm a professional, and I definitely said it, and you shouldn't go back and check that. Just you missed it. It was your fault. I think the listeners bought it, guys.
They may have.
So moving on very quickly, the book I've got is Soupy Leaves Home.
Yes.
And this is a story about a girl named Pearl in 1920s America during the Great Depression. She lives with an abusive father, so she decides she's going to run away from home and just live the simple life of a drifter. But because she's a girl, she decides that the only way she's going to be able to make it is if she disguises herself as a boy, who she decides to name Soupy, which, considering some of the other hobo names, isn't that ridiculous.
What were some of the other hobo names?
Well, the main one is the guy who kind of acts as her travelling companion and mentor is named Ramshackle.
Okay.
Then there's Professor Jack, the smartest hobo around.
Now, you see, that sounds like a sensible name.
Yeah, we're building up. And there's Gums McGee, who doesn't have any teeth. And finally, Tomcat Tuna.
A what?
Tomcat Tuna.
Is this like a brand of canned fish or something like that?
Nope. He's just a guy who calls himself that.
Okay. Now, you see, I what I'm struggling with here is this girl who leaves home, right?
Yeah.
Presumably doesn't have any real prior experience of hobos.
No, she does not. This is why Ramshackle kind of takes her under his wing.
But surely before there must be a period between her leaving home and meeting Ramshackle where she thinks that all she needs to do is disguise herself as a boy and call herself, I don't know, Dave.
Well, no, at first she doesn't give a name.
Ah.
But then, being a smart young woman, one of these evenings, she looks at a bowl of soup and says, I'm going to call myself Soupy. Because I don't know if you're getting the nuance of it. See, she has a bowl of soup, and so she takes the name of the soup. It's incredibly clever.
So her name's not Soup.
I would never have thought of it.
It's a good job she didn't take her inspiration from looking at a pile of poo.
Well, Ian, what soup was it? Was it minestrone? Was it mulligatawny?
Is that really relevant?
Well, she takes her name from soup. That's what he just said.
Yeah.
So what soup was it? Was it like cream of chicken soup? Is her name supposed to be cream of chicken?
Well, no.
I think you're misunderstanding the hobo lifestyle a bit. The soup is random assortment of vegetable soup, as all hobo soups are.
You seem remarkably well informed on hobo soup.
I have read 2 whole comics about hobos. I know all about them now. I'm the resident hobo expert.
I have no words. I bow down.
No, joke.
I bow down to your superior knowledge of the hobo lifestyle and indeed naming conventions.
Thank you. Here's another knowledge bomb for you.
Oh.
A hobo is a gentleman who finds work. A tramp is a drifter who goes from town to town but doesn't work. And a bum is someone who just mooches off the kindness of others and doesn't move around.
Wow.
That's another thing I learned from Soupy Leaves Home.
That's a very specific distinction, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, it's something... Because I have found myself reading a bunch of things about hobos now, I kind of do like this idea of, like, back when being homeless was more of a lifestyle choice, and this idea that, like, whole communities would spring up with their own, like, rules and regulations. Like, by the end, Soupy even has to go testify in hobo court.
Wow.
And what sentencing powers does hobo court have?
Basically, just the power to exile someone from hobo jungles, which are what they call kind of groups that kind of the big camps they set up.
Right. Ah.
It is genuinely interesting seeing like this entire sort of subculture that grew up in America. And even at the back, they even have a guide for the little signs that they put on places. You know, where it's just like a bunch of squiggly lines to say like, the person here will probably give you food.
Ah, right, yeah. Yeah, because that's an old trick that's been used by moonshine runners and rebel soldiers in various civil wars and stuff like that as well, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, just I love that idea that there's like this whole secret class of people moving about and finding ways to communicate with each other.
It's weird, because the more you describe it, the more I'm thinking Neverwhere.
Yes, very similar.
But yeah, well, I mean, I think that's probably where Neil Gaiman got the general idea for Neverwhere.
Oh, yeah.
You've also got similar references in things like Fallout on the games front.
Yeah.
There's an underground movement that's got little symbols saying that there's an arms cache here, and of course you've got Carney speak and things like that.
Carneys are another one. Did you ever see that TV show Carnival?
Yes.
who only had like two seasons, and both of them were amazing, and then it just got cancelled for some stupid reason.
Yes, I think it got cancelled because it was far too good for its own good.
Yeah, I know, and that I love that scene. I love that show so much.
And you then spent the next 10 years going, oh, it's so and so at a carnival.
Yes, I literally did. Didn't know who these people were. I just knew they'd been in Carnival. That's why I know their face. Yeah. Also, Andrew, if you get a chance to watch Carnival, if you haven't already, you should watch it. You will love it.
I have not, and I've never seen like anything about it.
You will love Carnival. It is exactly your type of show.
I think that was possibly its biggest problem, wasn't it? It just no one sort of tried to sell it to anybody.
But the thing is, if they just said it, literally all it needed for Carnival was for one person to step forward and go, "This is Carnival. This is what it's about," and it would have had us. It would have had us at hello, goddammit.
They would, but Andrew, a much underrated series.
It's your type of show. It's got that kind of mysticism, religion, the supernatural, hobos, effectively carny folk.
When did this come out?
It was around 2000, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And all the bits that Rob just...
knowledge, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say it might have been a bit before its time then.
It could well have been.
Yes, it was well... The thing is, if it had come out now, I reckon it would have been... it wouldn't have been cancelled.
Yeah. And it's set in very much the same era as Soupy. It's that sort of Great Depression, Dust Bowl era.
Yeah.
Across the Midwest. And is truly excellent.
It's interesting that we're talking about reclusive communities because I did Grass Kings not long ago, and this week I will be doing also from Dark Horse. Got a lot of Dark Horse this week, haven't we?
They sent us a nice... They basically sent us a care package.
Yes, they did.
Thank you, Dark Horse.
Yes, we love you. I got Briggs Land, which is by Brian Wood and Mike Chater, and this is Volume 1 called State of Grace. And it's very much like Grass Kings, which I talked about a few episodes ago. Briggs Land is basically one of those weird little private communities that you get in America where they tell you that you are no longer in the United States, you're on private property, blah, blah, blah. They have their own ways of doing things. Everybody is pretty much armed to the teeth. Imagine a scenario, you know, like you have the Westboro Baptist Church?
Yeah.
And they have their own little area of land and nobody goes there. And they have their own little, you know, all the little families that go to the Westboro Baptist Church all live on that land kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then you had like Waco and various other communities like that. Briggs Land is kind of like that. And Grass Kings is kind of like that as well. Briggs Land apparently has been, it's nearly 100 square miles of rural wilderness. And it's the largest and most secretive anti-government secessionist movement in the United States. And this starts off with Grace Briggs, the wife of the current patriarch of the Briggs family. She is visiting her husband in prison, where he is serving a life sentence for attempting to assassinate the president of the USA. Or they say attempting to assassinate the president. They found him in a room near where the president was with a load of weapons. So
he was probably going pheasant hunting on that grassy knoll.
Yeah. But Grace is there to tell her husband something important. Her husband is doing the usual thing because apparently they're all God-fearing, and because they're all God-fearing Christians in America, obviously the women don't have rights.
Just as it should be.
Yeah. And Grace
It shouldn't. It definitely shouldn't.
And Grace is there because...
I keep making that joke and then just backing out of it.
Yeah, I know.
I'm scared of the internet.
Grace is there.
Everybody's scared of the internet.
Yep. Grace is at the prison because what Grace is doing now, she's had enough, and she is literally, over the course of Volume 1, she performs a coup d'etat. She takes over from her husband, who's in prison. But that brings its own problems because not everybody on Briggs Land wants her to be in charge because she's a woman. And so you have some of the men who want to retaliate. She's got three sons and she gets those involved, but the eldest son is basically a white supremacist, as in a really violent one. Think Hitler Youth, but now fully grown.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's almost like the kind of people who decide to secede from the United States and form their own community.
Yep.
aren't always the nicest kind of people.
Yeah. Well, he's just one of the sons. The second one is kind of a, used to be in the military, and now he's going around just basically with his biker buddies, just doing stuff. And the third one is, he's a lot calmer. He also served in the military, and now he is the one who his mum trusts the most. And so she gets her three sons on board, and they now have to control the entirety of Briggs Land, which is this massive closed-off area, and she has to control it all. The thing about this comic is that the characters are actually quite realistic, a lot more so than I found with Grass Kings. Because Grass Kings, it just felt like the story was keeping people at arm's length, whereas Briggs Land, it feels like Brian Wood has said, look, this is how this whole area is, warts and all. Come and have a look, decide for yourself whether you like these people or not. You know, spend some time with them. It reads more like a really, really good and really interesting, but very twisted and very dark soap opera.
Is it written by the same people who do Hollyoaks?
No. If Hollyoaks was written by these people, Hollyoaks would be so much more interesting. But I've got to say, Mac Chater's art is very, very good in this. The characters are really, really well drawn. The scenery is really well done as well. The dialogue is very, very good. Brian Wood's story in this is just amazing. I opened it up and I couldn't put it down. I just wanted to know what happened next. I'm getting volume 2 because I really want to know what happens after this. This is the kind of series that would make a really good TV series. Yeah.
Until, of course, someone made a TV series of it and then it turned out to be not quite as good as you expected it would be.
Yeah, true. I say it'd make a good TV series, but you're exactly right. It could make the transition a lot easier than most of the comics, though. It's not as crazy, or rather, the people in this, only one of them is about as crazy as the people who were in Red State. You know, that strange movie from Kevin Smith.
Right.
Only one of the characters in Briggs Land is about as crazy as the most of the characters in Red State. But everyone else seems to have... Everyone has their own kind of goals, their own ambitions, their own driving factor. And Grace is the one at the head of it all. And what she's trying to do is trying to change the kind of toxic future that Briggs Land has and just kind of steer it in a much better direction. She's become, you know, she's married into the Briggs family, and the thing I like about her as a character is she's very clear on her goals, and she's very clear about what kind of problems she's going to face. You know, she's not kind of living in a fantasy land where hopes and dreams and the strength of her friends is going to get her through. She knows that she's going to have to pick up a gun and probably kill people with it in order to achieve her goals. And her goals are very simple, you know. Treat your women better and don't be so scared of everything that's outside. That's really what it boils down to for her.
Interesting.
I like it. I like it a lot.
I've become weirdly specialised on this show.
Yeah, no, you're the hobo specialist.
With like my 1920s hobos.
You're the hobo specialist. I seem to be the specialist on secessionist movements.
Which... And I appear to be science fiction and futurism.
I think you're just futurism.
Yeah, I can live with that.
I think futurism is so you. But yeah.
That's specifically like pre-19 futurism.
Yeah, actually, yes.
Retro futurism. It's a thing. I'm going to get t-shirts made.
We've basically become like mastermind contestants, haven't we?
Yes. Yes, we have.
What, where we all get very close, similar scores on our specialist subjects and then all bomb out badly when it comes to actual knowledge about the world?
No, I want to be an expert in secessionist movements because I want to just... I want to make one joke on Mastermind on national TV. If they ask, when was the last secessionist movement in America? My reply is going to be, when did the president go to the toilet?
Oh, dear.
Yes.
I make that three is killed now.
Yeah. This has been positively restrained for Rob.
Which makes you a serial killer, officially.
That's fine.
And on that bombshell, I guess we've come to the end of the show.
Oh, just one final note on a comic theme.
Yeah.
And linked to kind of what we were saying about the potential disappointment of a comic that looks like it's ideal material for an adaptation. I cannot believe how much I enjoyed Wonder Woman.
Cool.
Movie. Is it out now?
Yeah.
It is out.
Oh, sweet. I'm going to have to go see that then.
I've been hearing a lot of good things about it.
It's, you know, all the things they did wrong with BVS and Suicide Squad?
Yes.
Like throwing too much story in, being too fanboy friendly, all the rest of it. None of that's there. It tells a story from beginning to end.
Excellent.
Copes with the origins, gets through the action, gets a bit over the top CGI towards the end, but, you know, it's a superhero movie. But yeah, it heartily deserves the far superior ratings it's getting on the various interweb sites.
Fantastic.
In comparison to its stable mates.
I'm really happy about this.
Yeah, excellent.
Yes.
Go see it. Treat yourself.
Yes. So, on that note, we are at the end of the show. And if you want any of our other shows, then you can find them on Audioboom and iTunes. And if you are listening on either of those services, then subscribe. It'll keep you up to date with all of our shows. Subscribe to the Geek Show Podcast Network, and you can keep up to date with all of the shows on the network. Things like Cinema Eclectica, which is all about movies, Literary Loitering, which technically is all about books and the arts, but...
Well, we mention book names.
Yeah. We sometimes do talk about books.
The other week we talked all about James Joyce.
I know. I just finished editing that episode. Or rather, I finished listening to the episode after Graham edited it.
He was into butt stuff.
Thank you for sharing.
Oh, do you know, it's just like listening to Radio 4, isn't it?
It's not my fault. I was the one who wanted to call it James Joyce's Dutch Oven.
Yeah, but unfortunately we couldn't. So we decided to call it, Magic Balls and Where to Find Them.
We did. Go listen. That's a good one.
Yes. So, there are other shows on the network. Press X is a great one for video games. And we're getting better at reviewing them, honest. So, yeah. Until next week, I have been Rob.
I've been Mick.
And I've been Andrew.
And because apparently I am a serial killer, I will say it rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the jokes again. We'll see you all next week.
Thanks for listening.